Welcome to the Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. This is a regular podcast where we'll look at the history of the First World War and travel together across the battlefields from Ypres to the Somme and beyond. So what's in this week's episode? We're back on the Somme this week, and we're starting our walk in the village of Auchonvillers. Now, just like us, the British Tommy of the First World War often struggled to pronounce the names of some of these French villages, so he corrupted them. Foncavilliers became Funky Villas, Monchy-Breton became Monkey Britain, and Auchonvillers became Ocean Villas. And the village of Auchonvillers sat just behind the British front line on this northern part of the Somme battlefield. It was an area that we took over from the French in the summer of 1915, a year before the main Battle of the Somme. And the first units in the line here were men from the 4th Division. They'd just taken part in the Second Battle of Ypres in April and May of 1915 and were sent down here to the Somme for a rest. Now, the Somme at that time was very much a quiet sector. There were no major battles taking place here. It was just the day-to-day activity of trench warfare, all quiet on the Western Front. Far from quiet, of course, because there would be daily bombardments, there might be gas releases, there could be raiding, both you raiding the enemy trenches and the Germans raiding our trenches. There would be sniper fire, rifle grenades, trench mortars. So really, it wasn't ever quiet. But for these regular soldiers of the 4th Division, it was great contrast, the sort of intense fighting that they'd taken part in at Ypres just a few weeks before. And they spent their first month in the line here at Auchonvillers extracting bricks from the trenches, because the French had lined all of the trenches here with bricks to make them more sturdy. But what, of course, the British realised that this could create a double shrapnel effect, that when a shell went off, it wouldn't be just the fragments of the shell that would kill and injure soldiers, it would also be fragments of the brick. So the soldiers became labourers and extracted those bricks and removed them back to whence they had came, probably from the village of Auchonvillers, possibly May close by, or one of the other villages in this area, but the bricks were removed. And indeed, the whole infrastructure of this area of the battlefield was expanded upon in those months that followed. The 4th Division, these were regular battalions of regiments like the Lancashire Fusiliers, the East Lancashire Regiment, the Rifle Brigade, were then moved up to the Red Ann Ridge sector, and then other units began to arrive here. The Ulster Division was here for a short while. The 31st Division, they were made up of Northern Powers battalions from Barnsley and Bradford and Hull and Sheffield. They'd come from Egypt, having served on the Suez Canal, and they took over this sector as well in the spring of 1916. And then another division arrived from Egypt, like the Powers battalions, but it had served at Gallipoli the previous year. This was the 29th Division. Now, again, it was a regular army division. It had originally been comprised of battalions that had been in the far-flung corners of the British Empire when the war broke out, who were recalled to Britain on the outbreak of war, reformed into this new division of 12 infantry battalions plus all their support, and then sent off to Gallipoli, where they took part in the original Gallipoli landings on the 25th of April 1915 at Cape Helles, and then served throughout the campaign there at Helles. Some of the units also went up to Anzac and near Suvla, and then the division was pulled out right at the end of the campaign and then spent a bit of time in Egypt before arriving here on the Western Front again in the spring of 1916. This division would then play a pivotal role in the build-up to the Battle of the Somme. But they weren't the only ones here during the Somme. Many others came through here. And our walk will start on the southern edge of the village of Auchonvillers, Auchonvillers, near to the old Beaumont Road. A bit more about that in just a moment. And we're going to walk first into the local civil cemetery. Now, all French villages have a little cemetery like this. There aren't always war graves in them, although you do find them. And here we have a small collection of men, 15 graves, of which the majority are men from the 1st Battalion of the Border Regiment. They're noticeable because they're not the normal white Portland stone that we look for when we go into cemeteries of the First World War. This is a red stone. It's called Coarsehill stone. And it's quite fitting that it commemorates these men of the Border Regiment because it is a stone found in that part of Great Britain. Now, when you walk along the row of graves that are here, you'll see a noticeable date, and that's the 6th of April 1916, because these were men not killed in the front line, not killed going over the top. They were killed moving up to the forward area of the battlefield in a communication trench called Tipperary Avenue. Communication trenches were built to move troops from one line of trenches to another. Typically, there were three, a front line, a support line, and a reserve line. And to get from those, rather than have to move over ground, you moved up through one of these communication trenches. And in April 1916, there had been a raid on the German trenches in this area, and the Germans were retaliating with concentrated artillery fire. And the movement of troops from the Border Regiment up towards the front line had been seen by the Germans, and they hit them with a bombardment. And these are amongst the immediate fatalities in Tipperary Avenue Trench. When you look at the men that are buried here from 1st Battalion Border Regiment, many of these are veterans of Gallipoli, many who had taken part even in the original landings, had survived that campaign, only to be killed in what was then a quiet sector of the Somme battlefields. There's another grave in here as well, not actually as such a war grave. It is a former employee of the Imperial War Graves Commission and former guardian of the Newfoundland Park, which is not that far from here. This is the memorial park to the men of the Royal Newfoundland Regiments who went over the top for the first time on the 1st of July 1916 in the Battle of the Somme. And this gentleman, buried here, used to be in charge of that park at a time when I suspect there were very, very few visitors. And you do find these former war graves gardeners and graves like this scattered around different parts of the Somme battlefield. But if you're walking along the row of war graves, go right to the far corner. And it's, depending on the time of year, it can be difficult to see. It's only a few times that I've seen it myself, but there is a concrete bunker buried under here. Not a machine gun bunker, not a bunker with any other type of weapon in it. It was an observation bunker used on the first day of the Battle of the Somme to observe the attacks taking place up on the Hawthorn Ridge. And it was connected up by telephone to both brigade and divisional headquarters, and they could relay information back. And the catastrophe that unfolded here, no doubt, was relayed back by telephone gradually as it became apparent, as lines of men went up to that ridge and very few returned, and the outcome of the battle looked uncertain. And there are quite good views, particularly in the spring, from this corner of the cemetery up towards where the front lines were. But we'll leave the cemetery now and go back into the little apron of tarmac that marks the entrance to the Old Beaumont Road. The Old Beaumont Road was a name given to this track that lays before you by us, by the British. It's how it's marked on British trench maps. And when you look at it, it looks like a sunken lane. There are banks, steep banks on both sides in places where there's a lot of undergrowth and there are trees. And it was a route up to the front line for men moving up through the village of Ocean Villas. Typically, they'd be out of the line on rest in a village like Engelbillmare or Maymay close by, or perhaps a little bit further back at Louvencourt. And then they'd march down, come through those villages, and then enter the battle area, really, in a village like Ocean Villas, where the signs of war were apparent. There was a advanced dressing station in Ocean Villas to treat the wounded. There were gun positions, there were trench mortar positions, there were piles of equipment. And it was where the communication trenches in areas like this would begin. But they'd come up through the village, go into the Old Beaumont Road, and then often into the communication trenches beyond. Walking down it, to me, it's a very atmospheric place. I've walked down it in the spring, the summer, and in the winter. And every time you come through there, you're almost walking in the footsteps of the men that were there in 1916, and it makes you think of the accounts that we have of this area. The war poet and writer Edmund Blunden was here with the 11th Battalion, the Royal Sussex Regiment, later on in the Battle of the Somme, and he describes a walk in his book Undertones of War, coming down this lane up towards the dugouts that once lined the banks here, and And in the spring and winter, you can still see the indents in those banks where the dugouts and positions once were. And he describes in that summer picking blackberries out of the bushes here. And I too have done that in the years that I lived on the Somme and walked through here. So it's a very atmospheric place. It's one of those places close to the intensely visited locations on the Somme, like the Newfoundland Park and Thiepval, but off the beaten track and a place where you can almost reach out and touch the history of the Great War. And as you walk along it, you get more and more of a view of the ridge beyond. Hawthorn Ridge, so named because there was a hawthorn tree on it. And obviously when you begin to see the ridge ahead of you, you realise that any movement on this track could only be done at night, because if it was done during the day, then the enemy on the ridge there, the Germans, would see you and would bombard you and open fire on you. So the movement here was always at night. Further up the track, we meet a metal road, a road with tarmac on it. And we follow that to our right, and it takes us slightly uphill onto a sloping road that approaches the crest of the Hawthorn Ridge. And we'll just stop here for a minute just to orientate ourselves as to where we are. We're still behind the British front line. The old Beaumont Road is now behind us, and the village of Ocean Villa is behind us to our right. When I first used to come up here, in the field to your immediate right now, there were three tall trees in that field that marked the position of the light railway that ran through here. There was a terminus of it there. And we'd built, as part of that expansion of the infrastructure here in the spring of 1916, a light railway, possibly a tramway, to bring up supplies and equipment and ammunition towards the frontline area. And according to the war diaries, this was built on wooden rails to disguise the noise of the movement of the trucks when equipment were brought up. Sometime in the 1990s, those trees were cut down and the farmer removed them to expand the size of his field. Quite a common practice on the farming areas of northern France. And it was a bit of pasture land that had not really been disturbed since the war. And an amazing amount of war material came out of it, including a big long section of trench pump hose. So this was the pump that was used to pump water out of the trenches. It was a hand pump where soldiers pumped away with their hands, often two men on it, pumping the water out of the trench and through one hose in and another hose out over the top of the trench out into a shell hole or no man's land. And there's a big long section of it here with the big brass end to it that was then dropped into the water or dropped over the top of the trench to get the water away. So quite a poignant artifact, really, of the day-to-day activity of trench warfare. Now, if you look in the field to your left, this field, when you examine the trench maps of this area, was a huge network of trenches, many of them dug in the months leading up to the Battle of the Somme in July of 1916. And one of the trenches here was called Heaton Trench, H-E-A-T-O-N, named after 2nd Lieutenant Eric Rupert Heaton of the 16th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment. It was a public schools battalion. And it was now part of the 29th Division that had arrived here from Egypt and prior to that Gallipoli. Heaton had not actually served at Gallipoli. His battalion had joined it in France. But I like to think of Eric and his platoon being detailed to dig this trench. When you read his letters, which are now in the archives of the Imperial War Museum, you get a sense that his men had a great regard for him. And you do wonder as to whether it was them that suggested to him that this trench be named after their officer. And it was a little bit of immortality for him, really, with the trench named in this way. We'll come back to Eric later on in the walk. We'll continue up the track now to where it meets another track coming in from the right. This is now the official access from the Hamel to Ocean Villas Road to Hawthorn Ridge No. 1 Cemetery, which we can now see ahead of us to our left, with two almost symmetrical trees with the Cross of Sacrifice in the middle. Where we are now, and we'll pause here, is just in front of the British front line on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, on the 1st of July 1916. And this is an area where the 2nd Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers went into the attack. Their reserves were the 16th Middlesex. We mentioned them. That was Eric Heaton's regiment. They were over to our left, down in the valley, at a place called the White City. But they weren't really expected to be required, because not only was the bombardment going to assist in the attack here, the 252nd Tunnelling Company of the Royal Engineers had been working for some weeks on the construction of the Hawthorne Mine. This was one of a number of mines that were planned to be used as the opening gambit of the Battle of the Somme on the 1st of July 1916. It was a charge of 40,000 pounds of Amanol explosive, and it had taken some months for the preparation of this mine. The 252nd Tunnelling Company had done the technical work in the construction of the tunnels and the laying of the charge, but a lot of the donkey work to remove the spoil and the chalk and everything else was done by attached infantry battalions. Now, one of the veterans that I knew, Horace Ham, I went to interview him in the Star and Garter home in London, and he was a veteran of the 16th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment. He didn't know Eric Heaton, who we mentioned earlier, but he'd served with the battalion from late 1915 up until the time of the Battle of the Somme. And he told the remarkable tale of being an attached infantry soldier to a tunnelling company, of going down into the tunnels of the Hawthorne Ridge. His job was not to dig away at the tunnels or anything like that. It was just to turn up with an empty sandbag, remove some chalk, and then take that up to the level above and carry it away to a location beyond Ocean Villas where the chalk would be dispersed. Because if they just took it up to the trenches and threw it over the back of the trench or into no man's land, the white chalk would quickly be picked up on German air photos, and that would obviously indicate that some form of tunnelling was taking place here. So it was attached infantry soldiers like Horace whose job it was to remove this stuff. And it wasn't a job that he relished. He didn't like being deep down in these tunnels. He said there was a funny smell down there that he couldn't quite put his finger on, and it felt more dangerous being down there than it did up top in the trenches themselves. He remembered seeing one sapper working on a wheel, turning a wheel, pumping air down into the tunnels, and he wondered what would happen if that sapper stopped. And this was an issue for men like him attached to these tunnelling companies, is exactly the same dangers that the tunnellers themselves were exposed to were exactly the same issues for men like him. And there were casualties. If you look in Ocean Villa's communal cemetery, there are infantry soldiers buried in there who were killed on attachment to 252 Tunnelling Company. So Horace survived his encounter with the tunnellers. He went on to be wounded in the opening moments of the first day of the Battle of the Somme. A shrapnel shell exploded above him when his battalion was in the White City, and he was one of the first evacuated casualties from that area. He often remarked upon the fact that early explosion and that wound probably saved his life, given what would happen to the rest of his battalion on that first day of the Battle of the Somme. After recovery from his wounds, Horace returned to the Western Front in the winter of 1916-17, attached to another battalion of the Middlesex Regiment, and took part in the battles at Boom Ravine and then at Arras the following year. Horace lived to a ripe old age, and when I interviewed him in the late 1980s at the Star and Garter home, he was unusual in that he had no memorabilia from the First World War, no photographs, he didn't even have his medals. And when I asked him about this, he'd been a publican on the South Coast on the outbreak of the Second World War, and his wife had been fearful of what would happen if the Germans arrived. Would they pick on men like him who had served in the previous war? Would they be the first ones to be shot against the wall? So she made him burn all of his photographs, all of his discharge documents, and throw away his medals. So poor old Horace had absolutely nothing from that period of the war. Back to where we're standing, looking out across the Hawthorne Ridge. So on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, there would be a preliminary bombardment of the German positions. The positions on this part of the ridge were held by the 119th Reserve Infantry Regiment. It was a unit recruited from the Württemberg area of Germany in Stuttgart. In some respects, when you look at the composition of the battalion, it was in a way a sort of a Stuttgart Pals battalion, not that they really existed in the German army, but it was a locally recruited unit. And they had been in occupation of this area since the autumn of 1914. So they knew the ground absolutely intimately and had built up their defences on and around the Hawthorne Ridge. At the crest of the ridge, just over the crest, in fact, was the Hawthorne Redoubts, this strong point that the Germans had built with machine gun positions, mortar positions, thick belts of barbed wire. And on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, it was the job of the 2nd Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, to attack this. The bombardment would neutralise the Germans as they made their assault, but just to make sure, the 252 Tunnelling Company had laid this 40,000-pound charge underneath the Hawthorne Redoubt to blow it up and take out everyone concerned to enable this attack to be successful. Now, the problem came when, how do you decide when to blow the mine? Now, in some previous battles of the war, there'd been a fatal delay when mines had gone off in the combination between the infantry assault and the explosion of the actual mine itself. Sometimes it'd gone off too early or too late, and a whole argument built up. And one officer was keen on the idea of blowing this mine an hour before the attack. Others felt that that was too early. And in the end, the compromise was 10 minutes. It went off at 20 past 7 on the morning of the 1st of July 1916, filmed by Geoffrey Mallins over on the other side of the valley near the White City, photographed by Lieutenant Brooks at the same time. So it's become one of the really immortal images of the First World War, the explosion of the Hawthorne mine. How many Germans did it kill? Well, for many years we didn't know, and I went to the Stuttgart archives with my old friend Jeff Bridger in the 1980s to look into this subject. And we'd met a German historian on the Somme, Klaus Spät, who had very kindly put us up. And off we went into the German archives in Stuttgart to have a look at them. And with Klaus's assistance, we found the nominal roll of the company of the 119th Reserve Infantry Regiment that had held the ridge. And looking through that, cause of death had been given for these men, shot through the head by a bullet, killed by artillery fire, and then killed in the explosion of an enemy mine. So with that, we were able to put together a list of around about 26 men that had been killed in this explosion. So all those months of tunnelling, all that work, all those thousands of man hours had killed less than 30 German soldiers. Now, in anticipation that there might be some issues, a detached company of the Royal Fusiliers were sent forward with some machine guns and trench mortars, Stokes mortars, just prior to the main assault to capture the crater in case the Germans popped up. And as soon as they got there, the Germans did pop up and a firefight began. Now, to get there quickly, these men had not taken a lot of ammunition with them, and very soon their ammunition ran low. But that didn't matter, because in the first wave of the attack from the Royal Fusiliers, they would be carrying extra trench mortar ammunition, extra machine gun ammunition, and extra small arms ammunition for the men who had taken the crater. But as those men went over the top, they walked into the withering firepower of the German defenders, because the Germans, as we discovered on the Somme, did not keep the majority of their men in the front line. They were in second or third line positions. So the explosion of the Hawthorne mine underneath the redoubt had destroyed that redoubt, had killed 20-odd German soldiers, but the bulk of the garrison had survived. And that garrison reacted very quickly, coming up through tunnels, from their dugouts, up into the forward positions, to the lip of the crater, and open fire, not just on the men who'd got there first, but in the waves that followed. So very, very quickly, under this withering fire, the 2nd Battalion Royal Fusiliers melted away. The local commander then had to make a decision. Did he stop the attack, or did he continue with it? And it was at that point that he decided to bring up his reserves, the 16th Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment. Down in the White City, no doubt a runner arrived with some orders to make the assault. They were given the task of continuing with the attack and moving up the slope from the White City, head straight to the mine crater, take the crater and push on beyond. Led by Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton Hall, the battalion moved forward in good order and went up those slopes. It was filmed by Geoffrey Mallins, these ant-like figures moving across that ridge towards the crest, and then tens of minutes later, a handful of figures coming back, because exactly the same fate awaited them. They didn't just come under withering fire from the positions around the Hawthorne Redoubt. The Germans, who had been occupied on the northern flank with the attack of the Lancashire Fusiliers from the sunken lane, now turned their weapons into the flanks, the sides of the assault made by the Middlesex Regiment, and inflicted heavy losses on them too. Really, the attack broke down, and the casualties amongst officers were extremely high. In the Middlesex Regiment, only Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton Hall walked away from the battle. All of the other officers that went in were killed, wounded, or missing. One of those who would die that day is Eric Heaton, and we'll talk about his story when we get to the cemetery shortly. And one of his fellow officers was Captain Francis Sidney Cockrum. Cockrum was the adjutant of the 16th Middlesex Regiment. He was the man that kept their war diary and ensured that they were resupplied and kept on the move. On the first day of the Battle of the Somme, he decided to go into action with the battalion that morning. And he was seen by a brigade observer on the other side of the valley, walking through the waist-high grass. Now, we tend to think of no man's land as being this blasted wasteland, but it was an overgrown field with waist-high grass. And as Cockrum was seen to walk through that grass, walking stick in hand, he was hit by a burst of machine gun fire. He fell into the grass, incredibly picked himself up, took a few staggered steps, pointing towards the crater with his stick, was hit by a second burst of machine gun fire, fell once more, picked himself up again, took another few steps, again trying to point, and was hit again by a further burst of machine gun fire. This time he disappeared into the grass, not to rise again. And the observer who had witnessed this believed that Captain Cockrum had been killed in action. In fact, he noted that down in his report. Again, incredibly, Cockrum was still alive. He dragged his wounded body up to the lip of the crater where he passed out. He was picked up later that day by some German stretcher bearers from the 119th Reserve Infantry Regiment and was evacuated to their main dressing station at Miramont, where his life was saved. He became a prisoner of war in Germany, but he was so badly wounded that he was exchanged via Switzerland in 1917. Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton Hall, it was said by members of the battalion, including Horace Ham, who I interviewed, had recommended Cockrum for the Victoria Cross. In the end, he got a Distinguished Service Order, but that did not appear until the New Year's Honours List of January 1917, so it appears without citation. And those sort of awards often angered the veterans of the front line, because an award like that could appear at the same time as a DSO to an Army Service Corps officer who'd been awarded the medal for good work in baking bread at the depot in Rouen. Now, that was vital war work, but was it the same as staggering forward riddled with bullets, leading your men towards a mine crater on the battlefield? And there was nothing to distinguish the two awards. Cockrum again lived a long life, I'm pleased to say. He survived the war and he lived well into his 80s. A great survivor. The 1st of July was a disaster on this part of the Somme battlefields, with here over 5,500 casualties killed, wounded and missing, nearly 10% of the overall losses that day. And nothing really happened between the 1st of July and the end of the Battle of the Somme. Units came in and out of the line here. Raymond Asquith, the son of the Prime Minister, was in this sector with the Guards in August of 1916 before he too was killed in the fighting around Guillemont. But at the end of the Battle of the Somme, the 51st Highland Division was moved up to take part in one of the final assaults on the 13th of November. And that battle was in great contrast to the 1st of July. It's often said that the first day of the Battle of the Somme looked back to Waterloo and the 13th of November looked forward to Normandy. It was a very different approach to the fighting. More coordinated artillery, the better use of tactics, bombardments that would assist the men in moving forward across the battlefield. And here, 252 Tunnelling Company were detailed to blow a second Hawthorn mine. Lightning would strike in exactly the same place twice. The Germans had turned the crater into a defensive position, and a second mine turned this into a figure of eight mine crater, which you can see today. And this meant that the men of the 51st Highland Division who attacked here that day were able to get into the German trenches, fight their way through to the positions around Beaumont Hamel Village and the Wye Ravine further to the south, push through to the high ground beyond. And from here, you can see in the far distance beyond the village of Beaumont Hamel, several battlefield cemeteries, Munich Trench, for example, that sit on the spot where, in many respects, the Battle of the Somme came to an end in this sector. We're on the final phase of our walk now, and we're going along the track to the point where it runs level to the cemetery. And depending on the time of year, you can either walk straight across the field itself or through the crops. The farmer continues just as he should do to work around this cemetery, but obviously understands that people need access to it. So there was always a little bit of a beaten path. And at times, with the crops rising up above you and around you, and the cemetery sitting in the midst of that, it's quite a dramatic location, an impressive location. And moving to see the modern world continue around part of the old world which the cemetery represents. Going into the cemetery through the gates, we can see that there are two distinct rows of graves here. This is essentially a mass grave. There are over 150 burials here, and it was made during the winter of 1916-17 when the battlefields here were cleared. These men, many of them killed on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, lay out in the open, sadly, for months before their remains were finally buried here. And you'll see that there are multiple names on the headstones, again indicating that this is a collective burial, with in the middle of the row a single headstone with no name on it, just a cross. Because on the other headstones, where there are multiple names, there is no room for a religious symbol. Now this is a very special cemetery for me because of the burial here of Eric Heaton. When I first became interested in this part of the battlefield, in those days, the cemetery register, which is still kept in the little locker to your left as you walk through the gate, I looked at that and looked up Eric's name and saw that he came from Hove in Sussex. And I was living in Sussex at that time, and Heaton was not a common Sussex name. So I went to the local library when I got back, and in those days we had, before the internet, which I know is incredible to some people, but we had phone books in the libraries. And I looked for Hove, and there were three Heatons in Hove. I sent a letter to each one of them. One never replied. One wrote back and said, good luck. And the third one sent me a photograph of him and said, this is my brother. This was Irene Heaton. And I went to see her. Incredible lady. Her house was really a shrine to Eric. There were photographs of him everywhere. There were his medals, his memorial plaque, his memorial scroll. She even had a lock of his hair. And she told me the incredible story of this young man who was training to be a priest, like his father, had intended to go off to China to do missionary work, but the war got in the way of his education and his dreams, and off he went to fight. He arrived on the Western Front in the early part of 1916. You remember his men dug that trench, Heaton Trench, further down the ridge. And on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, he was last seen going through that waist-high grass, leading his men forward. He was never seen again. The family hoped beyond hope that somehow he'd survived, that he was in a German hospital somewhere, having lost his memory. But when the battlefields here were cleared after the 13th of November attack, his body was found, and they had to have the final acceptance that Eric had been killed. The family came here in 1919. His brother was an army chaplain. And the parents, Irene and her brother, visited Eric's grave when it was just a wooden cross, when the cemetery had not even been constructed. There's a photograph, which I'll put on Twitter, of them at the grave. They placed a little tiny plaque against his cross, and over 100 years later, that little plaque is still there, I'm pleased to say. That little link to one family's sorrow, one family's remembrance of a young man who'd gone into battle. But there's more to this story, because Eric wrote a last letter home, and I'll read that for you now. The letter was written in the village of Ocean Villas, where we started off in the lead up to the Battle of the Somme. It's dated 28th of June 1916, and it was one of those letters that was only to be posted in the event of his death. Eric wrote this: I am writing this on the eve of my first action. Tomorrow we go to the attack in the greatest battle the British Army has ever fought. I cannot quite express my feelings on this night, and I cannot tell you if it is God's will that I shall come through, but if I fall in battle, then I have no regret save for my loved ones I leave behind. It is a great cause, and I came out willingly to serve my king and country. My greatest concern is that I may have the courage and determination necessary to lead my platoon well. No one had such parents as you have been to me, giving me such splendid opportunities, and always thinking of my welfare at great self-sacrifice to yourselves. My life has been full of faults, but I have tried at all times to live as a man and thus follow the example of my father. This life abroad has taught me many things, chiefly the fine character of the British race, to put up with hardships with wonderful cheerfulness. How I have learnt to love my men. My greatest aim has been to win their respect, which I trust I have accomplished, and hope that when the time comes, I shall not fail them. If I fall, do not let things be black for you. Be cheerful, and you will be living then always to my memory. Eric was 20 years old. The original of that letter was posted home. His broken-hearted mother read it every night before she went to sleep. She kissed it every night before she went to sleep. She tucked it under her pillow, and when she died, the letter was buried with her. The echoes of loss on the battlefield, casualties, resounded way beyond the Western Front, and the women of the Great War were as much victims of that war as the men who died here in places like the Somme. And as the larks still sing above Hawthorne Ridge, it's young men like Eric that we think of when we come to places like these. These silent cities that act as beacons to the Great War, pathways to remembrance, part of our journey along the old front line. It's been quite a long podcast this week, but there's been quite a tale to tell, really. And to end with a Great War object, I'm holding in my hand just a postcard, but not just any postcard. When I did that research on Eric back in the 1980s and wrote to those addresses in Hove, this was the postcard that came back from his sister Irene. It's a head and shoulders shot of Eric in uniform, just commissioned as an officer in the Middlesex Regiment. And on the back, it says, Second Lieutenant Eric Rupert Heaton, Middlesex Regiment, July the 1st, 1916, Number 1, Hawthorne Ridge, Beaumont Hamel. The photograph was taken in Folkestone. Irene was an incredible lady. She gave me such an insight in what it was like to deal with the grief that the First World War threw on families like hers. And I remember looking at her family photographs and seeing pictures of her at that time, an incredibly beautiful young woman. And of course I traced her because she'd never married. And I asked her why, and she said, well, there were not many young men of my class left alive after the First World War. She said, but it was more than that. She said, my brother Eric was to me the epitome of what a man should be, and I felt that no man would ever really live up to that. So little artifacts like this, just a simple postcard, echo so many stories of the Great War. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. I hope you found this week's content of interest. Do take time to subscribe to the podcast. Follow me on Twitter at SomCorps and tell us what you think using the hashtag OldFrontline. Until next week, when our paths cross again on the battlefields of the Great War.